Hi and welcome back. This is episode number 314. Today, I am talking to Ariana Tobin. She is one of the reporters at ProPublica. They do a lot of really valuable investigative journalism, and they are based in New York. There was an article that caught my eye that we're going to discuss today with Ariana. The name of the article is Meet the Customer Service Reps for Disney and Airbnb Who Have to Pay to Talk to You. I really encourage everyone to go and read this article, anyone that's interested in the call center industry and the potential issues with the call center industry. And that is found on the ProPublica website, which is propublica.org. So go and check it out. But of course, we will have all of that in the show notes, and we will be talking more about that to Ariana now. The article explores the employment practices or lack thereof of a onshore US call center called Arise and how they go about recruiting and employing, in inverted commas, their call center agents. It's a really interesting article and one that I think is a concerning trend in terms of the utilization of the gig economy and contractors and self-employed people to effectively run a business. This story created a bit of a stir, and it was also co-published with NPR's Planet Money if you are a podcaster and want to go and listen to it there. So without further ado, I'm actually going to allow Ariana to introduce herself, ProPublica, and also the article. So enjoy. If you want any of the show notes, as always, go to outsourceaccelerator.com/podcast. Ariana Tobin, what's your role in ProPublica?
I am a reporter and an editor here, and I specifically work on the engagement and crowdsourcing team. So we do these big stories that often are fueled by lots and lots of people. We joke that like there are lots of different kinds of lawsuits, but for us, we kind of bring the class action lawsuit of journalism. So lots of people with either small pieces of a puzzle or different pieces of information, and try to bring them together with some journalistic muscle to lift up a bigger group that is, you know, having trouble organizing or banding together in some other kind of way.
What exactly is ProPublica then? Where do you position yourself as a purveyor of information?
ProPublica was founded about 11 years ago, and the motive was there were a lot of editors and kind of big deal names at big publications in the US, like from the New York Times and the Los Angeles Times and the Wall Street Journal, and they looked around at the other news landscape and various smaller papers and radio stations and television stations and realized that they were losing resources. And the very first thing to go as people run out of money is these investigative newsroom desks. So the kinds of stories that often require a lot of time or a lot of money or, you know, kind of leave space and room for people to start digging wells of reporting that dry up. It was just way too expensive. So the founders decided to create a newsroom that was funded by grants and donations as a nonprofit to make space for that kind of reporting. So when they started that all that long ago, it was a tiny newsroom of 10 people, and now we have well over 100. And the kind of work we focus on, we call it accountability journalism in the public interest. So we are certainly nonpartisan. We, you know, don't align with any kind of political spectrum. We have a pretty strict code of ethics, but we look for stories where there is someone in power generally doing something that they need to be held accountable for. And the metric that we use is called impact. And that's, there's a whole white paper on it if any of your listeners are interested. But what we, the way that we think about it is that something in the world actually changes. So we choose stories and we choose topics where someone needs to be held accountable and then kind of gauge the success and continue telling the story based on what happens in the real world after we put that kind of information out there.
Right. And of course, we'll link to that white paper in the show notes for anyone out there. What are your thoughts just generally on the dumbing down of general media and the cutting costs of media, and where do you see all that ending?
Yeah, I mean, I think in the US, the state of local news and some of those places that have been just doing wonderful community journalism for generations, it's really sad. It's really sad. And I also think it's really dangerous. Like, people are, if they don't have a news source that they know and they understand and they can trust, they turn other places for news. And that can sometimes, it happens without any real editorial oversight. It's at the whim of a lot of big tech companies that make a profit off of people's behavior, but not necessarily off their edification. And it's really quite scary to see that spiral. We have a couple of initiatives around local news where we're partnering with some of those newsrooms that have just been so gutted in recent years. And we're working with local journalists to tell stories from those communities. And it has been really cool. And we've done a lot of really good work and a lot of, you know, journalism that I could talk about for years and years. But it's a drop in the bucket. It's really, you know, something else needs to happen to make sure that we're really paying attention, even just to people in all different parts of the world.
Yeah, well done. I mean, it's a fantastic journey. And obviously, if you've expanded from 10 people to 100 people, there's obviously, you know, it's resonating. And how do you find it's being picked up by the audience? Are people supportive? Are people sort of relieved that there's still this bastion of investigative reporting?
Yeah, that's a great question. So it's interesting that actually when they founded ProPublica, again, you know, well over a decade ago, the idea was that everything we published would be done in partnership. And so all of our stories are available under a creative, but most of our stories are available under a Creative Commons license, which means that anyone can reprint it and post it where they believe that their readers will find it and take it. We also specifically strategize with partnerships. So like if we have a story about people who live in Alaska, we try to partner with a publication in Alaska that has a readership in Alaska and also where they know their brand and they know, you know, kind of who the people at, say, the Anchorage Daily News, they understand who they are. So we don't have to go looking for different audiences among, you know, sometimes very different investigations. But in recent years, our audience has grown quite a bit. Like, I think people are becoming more and more and more familiar with the name ProPublica. And that's for lots of different reasons, mostly, I think, related to especially the last 4 years, where when Donald Trump was elected, there was a big movement around like lots of different kinds of civic action for people who were worried about Trump, people who liked Trump. A lot of people, I think, were suddenly inclined to participate in public discourse. So we got actually a lot of donations and we expanded quite a bit because I think there was more of a hunger and more of an understanding of what investigative journalism means in a society and in a culture and why it's important. And then one thing leads to another. And so some of the publicity, I think, snowballed and became just much more sustainable over time. And we also built up the infrastructure, of course, to support those things. So when I first started, it was about 4 years ago, we had a development team that did fundraising for us, but we didn't have a particularly sophisticated like digital outreach strategy. And we hired some of those people. And I think that it's just been really great and really heartening to see how many readers we've gained in different parts of the country as we've been able to grow.
It just seems such a hard battle, doesn't it? Because it's not like media is dying. The quality media is dying and it's sort of being kind of buried. But it's not like there's a dearth of content out there. There's more and more content. So it's harder and harder to break through the noise. It's harder to get noticed, you know, because it's just everyone's now tweeting and TikToking and, you know, it's all about the Kardashians. And it's kind of crazy how polarized it is. There's still, you know, a huge need for quality content, but it's just diminishing in terms of the ratio of total content produced. Yeah.
Yeah, I think it's dangerous. And I think a lot of it, you just have to look back at the source, which is these places where people are discovering, you know, that news on TikTok or Facebook. And, you know, I totally believe that it's perfectly wonderful and fine to be interested in the Kardashians. But if there's someone making money off of every time you click on a post, And that means that they define a business strategy that prioritizes some news over others and means that people never, or, you know, that takes enough advertising dollars away from the people writing about a school board. That is quite scary. And it means that you're left with a lot of one and none of the other. So it's, I'm happy to work at a nonprofit where we get to really focus our time on those things. And I think people, readers and people who are the subjects of our investigations have also come to see the value in it as well. But it is very scary that I think for the state of the world.
So ProPublica caught my eye, and I'm very glad it did because of this one article that I hope we can talk about today. The title of the article is Meet the Customer Service Reps for Disney and Airbnb Who Have to Pay to Talk to You. So I really want to dig into this article, but I suppose initially just give us an overview of the article, but how you came across this circumstance and the need to actually write this article.
Yes. So it's a good story, but it's a long story. So I'll try to tell you quickly. But so most of the work that I've done at ProPublica has been focused on business and looking at different kinds of companies, especially technology companies that are trying to earn a profit at a way that might be to the detriment of the people using their service. So, or, you know, coming up against ethical quandaries or laws or trying to do things in secret that might hurt someone. So for the last, all of 2018, 2019, a colleague of mine and I were looking at the company Intuit, which makes the product TurboTax, which I really hope none of your listeners are familiar with because it's a product of the United States' really complicated tax code and tax system that makes it very difficult for a normal person to file their taxes. Whereas in many other countries, I think we've heard it takes people like a couple of minutes, 10 minutes, 15 minutes. Like for us, we have to basically hire accountants to even understand what it is that we're asking for in many cases. So
But Intuit itself is also produces QuickBooks, yeah, which is one of the very common bookkeeping apps, is that right?
Yes, the same company. And so Intuit, like they rely on the business of people who are struggling to keep up their books, as you're saying, or file their taxes. And the investigation, mostly credit to my colleague Justin Elliott, found that a lot of the reason that the tax code is still so complicated comes because of lobbying from companies like Intuit. And Intuit, for the privilege of using TurboTax, which can help you navigate this tax code system, often charges quite a bit of money. So it can be quite expensive to file taxes. And that oftentimes the people who are forced to pay these fees, according to the law and a deal that these companies struck with the IRS here, they're supposed to be able to file for free. So the lowest income earners are never supposed to have to pay to file their taxes. And that is not what was happening, as we found. So we published a story about how TurboTax fees were being forced upon people who had no idea that they were supposed to be able to pay their taxes for free. And sometimes we're paying hundreds of dollars for the privilege. And when we published some of those stories, there was a pretty remarkable amount of outrage. And the natural course of that outrage was that eventually people realized that they should call TurboTax and ask for their money back. So we had written a story about someone in our audience who had called TurboTax and said, I read this ProPublica story, I'm entitled to a refund. And for that one person, it worked. And we published the phone number that he called to say that, just like as a, you know, FYI, this guy called this number and he got his money back. And eventually enough people and enough of our readers and others on the internet who found this story had called TurboTax customer service that we started hearing from the customer service representatives who were taking those calls where people were saying, I read this story in ProPublica and you should really give me my money back. And the customer service representatives were calling to talk to us about TurboTax, but in the process, we also became very curious about their jobs because, of course, as you and all of your listeners know, they weren't working for TurboTax. They were working for outsourcers. And the outsourcers that TurboTax uses, they use a number of different third-party contractors and BPOs. And so we started to research each of those, trying to learn more about them and the shape of the jobs for these people on the other end of the line. And some of the stories we were hearing, as you some have made it into this story, some we're still working on, were fairly troubling.
And so that brings us to Arise. I assume when you heard the stories of these customer service agents, were they even able to disclose that Arise was effectively their head employer, or were they only able to introduce themselves as individual business owners?
So that's a great question. The very, very, very first person who got in touch with us actually was from Arise, and she was just pretty honest, like more so than probably her, a lot of other people have been very nervous to talk to us because they're under a lot of layers of secrecy. But this person, she'd only really worked for Arise, not worked for Arise, but had been in contract with Arise for about 2 months. And she was so angry because she'd finished this job. She was like, I'm not going to do this. And realized that she'd made almost no profit, no income off of this entire experience after 2 months of working. So she was angry enough that she really talked with us. And what she told us about her experience with Arise, which was the first outsourcer that we really learned about, was like, I put in all of this investment and got almost nothing back. And I didn't understand it. So when I started, I thought I was doing this one thing. It seemed great, but I did not understand what it was that I was signing up for. And we just found that really interesting because, like, when, I like to think we are fairly good readers and business reporters, but when we started looking into Arise, we were also like, what is this? And trying to think about, how a person just stumbling upon it, looking at these advertisements might react.
And so let's just go back a little bit for those that haven't read the article. The article obviously is about Arise, which is an onshore call center, for want of a better word. I suppose part of the issue is the sort of aspects of call center practice, but the bigger issue here is really the state of the employment of the individuals carrying out the work. Can you just give an overview of really what you found after you did that initial digging? What is this article about?
Sure. So the way Arise works is that you start out, you do not join a business. You are not an employee of Arise. You don't work for Arise necessarily.
But and Arise is basically a call center, and it has incredible, prominent clients such as Disney and Airbnb. Yeah? And to the client, it offers traditional call center onshore services.
Yeah. So Arise offer customer service, they offer sales, they have contracts with many big name brands. As you mentioned, there's Disney and Airbnb, there's also Walgreens, there are also AT&T and a lot of other brands that people are regularly calling for customer service assistance. And the way that Arise describes themselves is they would not say that they are a call center company. They would say that they are a platform for small business owners to work with some of the premier brands doing call center work. So they think of themselves as a network of tiny call centers, and that they Arise in the middle there, connects those tiny call centers with those big name clients at the end. And so you have a bunch of customer service representatives trained by these big name companies, taking calls for those big name companies, but they are in their Arise model set up in business for themselves. So Arise says, hey, little tiny call center business, you, if you do all of these things, you can take calls for this big name brand and work as many hours as you possibly can. And like, as long as you you know, take all the calls, then like you're going to go through our complicated network of system, but you're all by yourself, you're independent, but you're taking calls for these big brands and we're going to facilitate that for you. So,
and so in effect, these call centers, well, let's call it a call center, they, instead of employing staff and taking on all of those liabilities and responsibilities that comes with standard employment, they are effectively telling people that they can buy or create a business, which then gives them access to the flow of calls. And they're effectively getting these quasi-employees to not just work for them, but to actually pay to set up and work for them and pay to get the test done and qualifications so that they can then effectively go onto the shop floor and start working for a rise. Yeah. I mean, it resonates with the, I mean, it's very similar in a way to the whole Uber story, isn't it? Really, how you have to get your own car, get your own insurance and qualifications, and then you can then become an Uber driver.
Yes, you've summarized it much better than I can. So that's exactly what happens. And that's also how Arise advertises themselves to the prospective agents. So they say, you know, like an Uber driver, the big promise is you can be independent, you can drive whenever you want, you don't have a boss, you can have a flexible schedule. And that's what Arise advertises as well. And they advertise all over. I still have Facebook ads coming into my feed all of the time. And what they say is like, you can also grow this business. So you put in as much as you can, you work hard, you get paid a lot. The difference between a company like Arise and a company like Uber, or at least as you know, different lawyers have argued, is that with Arise, you, as an Uber driver, you really can work whatever hours you want. You know, it doesn't mean you're going to earn a profit. There's all kinds of questions raised there as well. But with Arise, you are picking from generally a pretty limited supply of hours. And you're also, as any call center worker knows, you're held to a pretty strict standard of metrics, everything from how long you pause between sentences and how you answer specific questions and whether or not you hang up on a customer who's being rude to you. All of those things, you're evaluated very, very, very closely. And those metrics are set by the end client. So with Uber, that's a pretty it's a pretty different story. So they portray themselves like Uber, but as we've kind of seen, as we've been researching this and looking at various lawsuits, that's not exactly how it seems to play out in practice.
Wow. And again, just to provide more background, these are home-based workers. They particularly sort of target you know, parents, single mothers, people of color, and people that really do need a good job. And they then are put in a position where they have to buy and pay for their equipment, for their training. What are the typical outlays to basically get set up? This podcast is brought to you by Outsource Accelerator. We are the world's leading outsourcing marketplace and advisory. We help big and small businesses with their outsourcing needs, and we can help you too. We cover everything from business and staffing strategy, optimal outsourcing structures, implementations, and fully managed services. If you're already outsourcing, about to start, or somewhere in between, then we can ensure that you get the best from outsourcing. That's the best prices, best terms, and of course, the best results from your outsourcing practices. We list over 700 outsourcing suppliers on our website, host this leading outsourcing podcast, and have over 5,000 pages of content. Because we span the entire market, we can ensure that you get the best deal possible. We offer everything from light brokerage, co-managed services, through to fully managed solutions. Get in touch today. Visit us at outsourceaccelerator.com/quote. Mention that you're a podcast listener, and we will give you special attention plus a 10% discount. This is for a limited time only. Go to outsourceaccelerator.com/quote.
Yeah, so what then they say, you're an independent business, you put in the investment, it'll all pay off. And by investment, what they mean is you have to, as you said, buy all of your equipment. And for some clients, that is very specific equipment. For Airbnb, for example, you have to buy a Chromebox that is worth often hundreds of dollars. I think I've heard up to $600. And then you also, in most cases, have to pay a fee for getting started for the training course. So you have a required training course, and that can vary anywhere from a $50 fee to like a, I've heard up to $300 fee that requires before you can even begin, that you have to take this class. And sometimes the class can last for 2 months. So then you're also not only paying for the class, you're also not getting paid for the time that you're taking that class. So that's hours of your time where you're not earning income in any other way. You also sometimes have to pay for, you have to have a perfectly quiet office. So we've heard that that requires an upfront investment. And then on top of all of this, once you actually start working for Arise, or not working for Arise, I'm sorry, it's very difficult to get the phrasing right in these cases sometimes. But once you start taking calls, you are paying a fee to Arise out of each paycheck for use of their platform. So that can be at least $20 every 2 weeks. And then on top of that, often people are who have set up in these small businesses, sometimes what they choose to do is to hire more people, but underneath them, or to get contracts with more people who can take calls, but you facilitate the relationship between those people and Arise. So this gets very complicated, but those, what they're called, independent business owners, will often also take a cut out of an agent's paycheck each time. So sometimes you're paying fees to two layers of people above you on top of putting all of the output for the kinds of expenses that you might need to invest to get started at all.
And so why, you know, if people don't have a lot of money to start with, why are they doing this? Is there a big promise of you're earning, you know, three times what you would potentially earn in a standard call center job? What is the promise to get people on board?
The promise varies, but the biggest promise, I think, is that you're talking about people who need something. Like, they often, the most people who work for Arise, they've bragged about it themselves, tend to be women, and women tend to have other caretaking responsibilities, whether that's having kids, having other people in the home who they need to care for, having to navigate around other people's schedules. We also know that there are a lot of people who have disabilities who need to be able to work from home, and they often need to be able to work on a flexible schedule. So for those people, a lot of times the promise that appeals to them the most is, this is a job, right? Like, maybe there's all this cost at the beginning, but it's better than nothing. And it does. And I will say, for some people who get started with Arise, it is a job. Like, they do eventually earn something from it. From a lot of other people, however, I think that promise to be able to say, like, you're going to be able, if you stick with it long enough and you put in the time, that doesn't necessarily happen or pay off. It is something that feels to them like a false promise, because the turnover rate for a lot of these companies is just so high. So there are definitely people who go in, put in the time, and then after a while do start to earn some kind of income and profit. But there are so many other people who also get started and then maybe they don't even make it through the training. A lot of people fail the trainings, or they make it through the training, they start working, and then their metrics aren't up to snuff based on what that final end client and evaluators at Arise believe. So they get fired. So it's, I think that the promise of how it's supposed to work just isn't always how it works for people in practice, which is where they really run into problems.
And it just seems like a bit of a small-time con job, to be honest. You know, and it's a shame that people get sucked into this, but you'd think people would realize, you know, they'd be found out, and then that's the end of it. How big is Arise, though?
Arise has grown quite a bit during the pandemic. We know that at one point they had 70,000 people taking calls for them, and I believe that they've both added and kind of are always adding and subtracting clients, so that number can go up and down. I think another appeal, so there's the appeal to the agents, which is this idea of flexibility, being able to own your own business, not having to have a boss. But then there's also the appeal to the big end client brands who are signing contracts with Arize and saying, we do want to work with you. And one of the best parts for them is that, say right now it's before the Christmas season, right? So there are a lot of people shopping and trying to get gifts, trying to, you know, big time for a lot of these retailers. And so they need more people to be answering the phones. And Arize can have this army of agents who are promised this flexible kind of hours, and they can scale up and scale down really fast. And it doesn't cost Arize anything for the most part, because they haven't had to pay for these agents' training. They haven't had to do any kind of like regular, you know, paying out of benefits or things like that. So they can bring a lot of people on and then immediately get rid of them pretty quickly and just change the number of hours available that an agent can sign up for to work. Oh, I was going to say, you said, like, how were they not found out? Isn't, I think a lot of it is like, it works really well for the end client and it works pretty well for Arize, and it, for some people, does work. But all of these people are also under pretty strict non-disclosure agreement. And the whole thing is supposed to be pretty secretive, right? So it's not like this gets a ton of publicity, because there are a lot of agents out there who, even if they've had this terrible experience, they don't understand that there are other people out there who have also had terrible experiences. So that's really why we wanted to do this story.
Yeah. And, you know, it, so again, just to sort of try and simplify the model, effectively, typically businesses have a client side, which would be like Disney and Airbnb, and then they have the employees that they pay to do the job to serve the clients. But effectively here with Arize, it is a platform, as they describe, and they're making money off both sides, aren't they? They're making money off the client, and then also they're making money off the people that then actually do the work. And as you say, there's obviously a certain proportion of people that are productive enough and earning enough so that it's viable for them, but they're also, you know, clipping the ticket on many hundreds or thousands of people every month, which are paying for setup and paying for fees, a little bit like a franchise arrangement where they just never get started, but it's a healthy secondary business for Arize, I would assume. Are you concerned? I mean, to me, you know, I'm obviously familiar with the offshore staffing and outsourcing industry, but this is the first time I've heard of this kind of structure. And, you know, again, it's thanks to yourself and ProPublica to bring this to the surface. And I think, you know, any unethical practice should be discouraged. Is it concerning to you that obviously every other call center in the US must be aware of this and must be looking at this? And, you know, do you think they're going to their lawyers saying, you know, should we do this as well? Can we do this? Is this viable? Do you think this is something that could potentially spread to every call center? Or do you just see it as a bit of a wart on the back of the industry?
So Arize is not the only company with this model. There are others that also use the independent contractor system to staff. Those include, there's a company called LiveOps, there's a company called Working Solutions, there's a newer one called NexRep. So this model is absolutely out there, and it's not just Arize, and many of those companies also have many other big name clients. And what, you know, it's, there are arguments for them, there are arguments against them. We tried to put some of those into the piece, but what a lawyer who we talked to, the way that she described it was basically it puts pressure on the market. So what Arize offers clients is onshore American voices on the other end of the line at a cheaper price than they would have if they had a brick and mortar center. It's not necessarily less expensive than if you have a call center set up, say in Manila, but it is a deal for something that a lot of customers want. And if you take something like the TurboTax example, where we're talking about the complicated American tax code, that's something where hiring agents who live in the US means you can sometimes save a couple of steps of explanation in training, because it's a very American phenomenon and maybe you want someone who lives within the country. So what that does is that means that the other brick and mortar call centers who they might be competing with on US soil, those are likely more expensive, and Arize can offer a better deal. And so it puts pressure on the market, yes, to change and adapt. Arise has been around since the 90s, so this model isn't brand new, but within the last couple of years, it has absolutely been growing. And it is something that I think when people were reading the story, when lawyers are reading the story, when you're thinking about it from a policy perspective, you absolutely do need to think about the ramifications on the market.
And so this hasn't gone unnoticed. And of course, ProPublica has brought it more into the public eye, but it's been challenged legally a number of times, isn't it? Like a lot of the employees, for want of a better word, of Arise have challenged this. Some have won, most have lost. Can you explain that?
Yes, it's been challenged a number of times, and it's been challenged in a few different ways. So the most important kinds of suits against Arise, what they're claiming is it's called a misclassification lawsuit. So it's when you have a company or you have an employment relationship that they say is not an employment relationship. So it's not that one person hires another and you have a contract, and then the employer, the company in that case, is responsible for giving the employee benefits like health insurance here in the US or vacation time or sick days or any of the other stuff that you think of when you think about having a company and an employer. And what the misclassification lawsuits say is you're asking us to behave like employees, but you're not giving us any of those benefits. We're independent contractors, but we shouldn't be. You should look at the kind of work that we're doing, the level of scrutiny that it requires, and the amount of there's actually a test that has come up in both court and some regulatory agencies a number of times. And by each of those metrics, that's how you're supposed to judge whether or not the employment relationship is legal. So one of those cases happened, it was a class action lawsuit against both Arise and Apple, which was the company that the agents were taking calls for about Apple products. And that was years ago, and it took place in California. And the judge in that case ruled in favor of they settled the case, actually. And we don't know what happened, but we do know that the employees got, or sorry, not the employees, even I get confused talking about this, but the agents in that suit walked away with a settlement. After that, Arise stopped doing business in California, where labor laws tend to be more strict and have become, you know, different levels of strict in the US sense. Mm-hmm. And then there have also stopped doing business in other states that tend to have stricter labor laws as well. And there has, in the previous couple of years here, I think most recently in 2017, there have also been a number of cases brought by the same lawyer. Her name is Shannon Liss Reardon, in front of the National Labor Relations Board, which handles misclassification cases, where she was trying to be able to bring a class action lawsuit, but couldn't. And Arise, as part of their contract, asks an agent to sign away, essentially, their right to sue. So you have to settle each individual agent's case in private with an arbitrator, rather than going to court and having a public record or document of it. So she was bringing these misclassification lawsuits one by one by one, and was also she was winning each time, as far as we know. So we've been able to look at the transcript of some of those. And each time the judge would say, yes, this person is behaving like an employee. They're entitled to the rights of an employee, or you need to change your model. And so she was winning one by one. But when she tried to bring them all together, because they had this clause in the contract, it gets quite complicated. But basically, it meant she was not allowed to bring those cases together. And so it couldn't really make that much of an impact, because what's one person out of tens of thousands, or perhaps even, you know, hundreds of thousands? So Arise could pay out a small settlement each time, but they didn't have to fundamentally change the model.
You would think, you know, the issue being faced is really the misclassification, as you mentioned, which is defining what is it, in effect, an employee as a contractor, and then putting the burden onto the contractor instead of the employer, in terms of, you know, all the sort of employer obligations. You would think that after decades or of testing, of legal sort of testing, there would be an easier, quicker test, and people could easily say that, you know, this is clearly an employee and you're pushing the limits here. Why do we have to go through the whole court system every single time? And then also, if there's a clear sort of perpetrator, such as Arise, that is building a business model off this misclassification, then they can't continue. Is it not that simple? Is it more convoluted than that?
I think it's become convoluted. It's become convoluted, but I do believe there's just in the next couple of years, I think that this is going to be a topic of conversation in the Biden administration. There are different solutions to these problems, different arguments that come from various parts of the political spectrum and also the business world. So I think we'll see. There was recently, as you know, a proposition passed in California called Proposition 22 that changes the way that independent contractors that test essentially and how they're classified. And it has precedent, I would say. Like, I think they companies themselves, like Uber and Lyft and DoorDash, who were fighting for Prop 22 to pass, are looking at federal labor law next. But at the same time, you have politicians like Elizabeth Warren, who's, you know, very pretty far on the workers' rights progressive side of things, lobbying counter plans and arguments. She's a really big advocate for what's called an ABC test that is much simpler and more public than we currently have. So it's something that there's a lot of policy conversation and energy and thought around it that I have a feeling are going to hear quite a bit about in the next couple of years, unless there's another, you know, new disaster eclipsing that conversation.
Yeah, and it's obviously been popularized, hasn't it, by Uber, by the gig economy, and you know, I suppose like the internet's a wonderful thing and marketplaces are a wonderful thing, but it can kind of fractionalize work and services, which are great as a consumer. But if you are the one producing those services and you have to sort of piece together a bit of a job or a career by doing 1,000 individual little jobs, it can be, you know, it's not a great life often, is it? And I think the gig economy is bringing that into focus. And in some ways it's amazing. It's an enabler, but in other ways, you know, we're then just losing the foundation of giving people a real job with protection and with the structures around that has been determined that people deserve. Yeah.
Yeah. There's an excellent book on this subject called Gigged, like G-I-G-G-E-D, by someone named Sarah Kessler, that if you're interested, I highly recommend. It's really the system that we've set up to be able to support people is extremely reliant on having an employer or having someone in your family have an employer. And a lot of people are working jobs without employers. And it works well for some, but it really doesn't for a lot of others. But it's kind of often the only option left to have any income at all.
And it's about finding that balance, isn't it? Because obviously the companies are doing this because there is a cost incentive. They're exploring this route because there's a cost incentive. And obviously the cost differential is big enough that it's worth exploring and worth going up against the courts. Do you see this always as a bit of a push and pull and a sort of tug between, you know, kind of forcing the costs onto the individuals as opposed to the business and client?
That certainly arises model, and it's certainly making business sense for the companies that are choosing to sign contracts with Arise. So yes, I think you've hit it spot on.
Have you seen any evidence, you know, and this is what would concern me, but that the more traditional standard call centers are adopting this new method or method, if it's not new?
You know, I've been to a couple of industry conferences in the last few years, and there is quite a bit of talk about moving toward the gig economy. I don't know, I haven't heard that exactly, but I know that the idea of these models are on their radar. So I think there's kind of, it's yet to be determined, and we're going to continue reporting. So if any of your listeners have ideas on that topic or thoughts about, you know, how people at more traditional outsourcing and call center companies are taking this, please be in touch.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, so we are based in the Philippines, and we largely represent Philippine offshore staffing. But I'm quite, you know, proud to say that the Philippines is very is pro-labor. Now, of course, sometimes you can go a little bit extreme with any position, and it's about finding that right balance. But all of the, I can't say all, but, you know, offshore staff and generally in the Philippines, the staff are earning a very good salary. They have very good conditions, and the government, you know, is seeking to enforce that, which is good, you know, and I think good business is done when everyone is winning from it. But it just always amazes me in the US. I suppose it's kind of the innovation culture. People are always looking for ways to sort of restructure things to the benefit of one, to the downside to the other.
Yeah, our labor law history is pretty complicated. Yes, definitely.
And so you were saying the call center agents are sort of fractured, and they're not able to, you know, they're sort of bound by confidentiality contracts. They're not able to group cases. But so what impact has your article had? I imagine every single agent has read your article.
You know, I don't know about that. We're actually trying to think of ways to make sure that the article is getting in front of agents. And we're trying to talk to some like more local news stations and places where we hope people will come across this work. But it's interesting. I don't like if, say, someone out there, you work at a big company and someone out there published an article about where you work, I do think everyone would have read it. In this case, I don't know how much of an, like, people don't necessarily think of it as their employer. There are lots of people who are angry, but it's been somewhat difficult to get the word out. And I have heard from dozens of people in the time since who do want to talk and who have told us more stories. We've heard of lots of other kinds of customer service agents who say that there are plenty of other issues at these other outsourcers as well. Some even as full employees or partial employees who we know have been struggling with their own working conditions in some ways. So we're not quite sure yet what the impact will be, but we will keep everyone posted. And we're hoping to understand other parts of the industry as well and write some more stories from that kind of initial group of agents who reached out to us to talk about their working conditions. Arise certainly wasn't the only place that sounded like it had its issues.
And has there been any reaction from the big name clients from these brands that are sort of known and used in every household? Have they had any response or reaction?
Very little. We reached out to all of the ones we named in our story, and very few of them provided any kind of substantive comment.
Wow. And just on a side note, I have been hearing and learning a lot recently about ISAs, income share agreements. I'm putting you on the spot here. I don't know if you know anything about them, but effectively, people that are effectively getting free education, but then they have a loan to repay once they get a job. You know, I see that as a fantastic tool with a lot of potential, but also I could see it as being divisive and people becoming indentured. You know, once they've got a job, they have this huge loan to pay off just for getting a job. Do you see any sort of, I don't know if you're even aware of it, have you seen that on the radar at all in the US?
You know, I haven't, but it's very interesting and it does remind me of some of the promise that people make with Arise. Yeah, please send me more information about that. That sounds like it could potentially be a good next story.
It's really blowing up, and it's big in Silicon Valley. It's got a lot of the big Silicon Valley investors on board. Lombarda School is one of them. But I'll send you the information. And look, again, I think if it's done well, it's a fantastic tool. Instead of people having to spend $200,000 upfront, once they get a job, they can repay things. But it also has a bit of a dangerous potential to it as well. Fantastic. So thank you so much, and thanks for, you know, spending your valuable time. It's getting late there. Ariana, of course, I'm going to point everyone to the article and to Gigged, the book that you recommended. But is there anything you want from the audience or you want for this this article to happen?
Well, we have a survey up. You can find it on the page with the article, but I'll send you the link as well. if you know anything about the customer service industry, please, if you know anything about the customer service industry, please fill it out and be in touch.
Wonderful. Thanks so much, Ariana.
Thank you so much.
That was Ariana Tobin of ProPublica. And if you want any of the show notes, go to outsourceaccelerator.com/podcast. Of course, we put all of the show notes, all of the links into the show notes. So anything that Ariana mentioned within this podcast will all be there. And as always, if you want to ask us anything, then just drop us an email to ask@outsourceaccelerator.com.